This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
In short, Excellencies, I believe the time is ripe for a hard look at fundamental policy issues and at the structural changes that may be needed in order to strengthen them. History is a harsh judge. It will not forgive us if we let this moment pass.
United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan speaking Tuesday to the UN General Assembly. Issues attendant with the rebuilding of Iraq dominated the week's meeting, but Mr. Annan also challenged member states to look seriously at rebuilding the United Nations. Dan Shore is away. We're joined now by John Parker, who's the Washington Bureau Chief of The Economist magazine. John, nice to have you back.
Good morning, Scott.
Mr. Annan said this was a very propitious moment for the UN, that it had to change itself to remain or arguably even become an effective world-governing power. What kind of reorganization does he seem to want?
Well, I think, first of all, he's talking about reforming the Security Council. These are, as it were, that's kind of first order. But the big issue is simply trying to get the UN reform on the agenda in order to make it work, to make it more acceptable to, you know, the big powers. And it's that sort of broader ambition which I think is the main thing. There's a sense that, you know, we've needed a debate about what on earth the UN is for and how to make it work properly since the collapse of communism, since the end of the Soviet Union. And we just haven't had it. So I think the most important thing is he's putting that debate on the agenda. And the way he's doing it is talking about, you know, should we have five permanent members of the Security Council, or should there be more? Who should they be? Should each one have a veto, or maybe there should be some kind of supermajority? That kind of thing on the Security Council.
And Mr. Annan himself acknowledged that the UN perhaps had not been as proactive as it should have been in addressing or becoming involved to deter genocides. He mentioned Congo, Rwanda, the Balkans.
Right, and I mean, people often during the debate on Iraq took the UN approval or sanction for military action as a sort of a requirement. But actually, there's only been two UN-sanctioned military operations in the UN's history. So it's, and there have been hundreds of wars, so it's not as if, as it were, the UN has stepped in terribly often here. Mm-hmm. And that's quite widely taken as a symbol of their, you know, inability to get to grips with the dangers and tensions around in the world.
Well, he will need support from the major states for this kind of reorganization, won't he?
That's putting it mildly. Yeah, I mean, clearly the current permanent members of the Security Council aren't going to give up their position terribly willingly.
President Bush, of course, addressed the UN General Assembly, wanted to enlist international donations of money and troops for Iraq, but he turned back calls for any quick transfer of power. Was he talking to the American public or the General Assembly?
Well, he was talking to the General Assembly, of course. It was the opening of the UN annual session. But, I mean, your question is a kind of appropriate one because there was a quality about the speech which was sort of just going through the motions. I mean, it was pretty clear that the Americans weren't going to get many troops and hardly any money for rebuilding Iraq. So there was precious little reason for him to sort of apologize for anything in order to get concessions, and certainly Chirac was not in the mood to forgive America. So there wasn't much there by way of kind of negotiations.
Secretary of State Colin Powell said later this week that an Iraqi constitution is possible, drawn up by Iraqis within 6 months. Now, is that a political position or a policy?
It's like a sort of general target date, so I think probably more like a political position. It's a bit of a sop to French demands, I think, for a timetable which the president didn't lay out. But realistically, I doubt that it's a serious deadline, because the Grand Ayatollah of the Iraqi Shias recently said that only an elected assembly can write a kind of a legitimate constitution in Iraq. Now, that implies, of course, there has to be elections first. So the possibility of having elections, or drawing up a voter list, then having elections and then writing a constitution within 6 months seems pretty remote, to put it mildly.
Particularly, isn't the official United States position position that there has to be a constitution in order to have elections.
Exactly. So we have that slight chicken and egg problem to get over first.
Gallup poll numbers released this week showed President Bush's approval rating at its lowest point since the start of its presidency, just under 50%. We can all adventure some guesses as to what may have caused it. The people polled volunteered it themselves between the economy, between a deepening commitment in Iraq. What, in your judgment, John, is going to be the effect on this White House and on national policy of these poll numbers?
I would say, first of all, that the poll numbers aren't predictions that Bush is certainly going to lose the coming election or is in deeply serious trouble, because Bill Clinton had very similar poll numbers in 1995 and went on for re-election. Those poll numbers were at the same point. So I don't think it's a forecast, but I do think that it puts Bush into sort of new territory now in the run-up to the campaign in the next few months. He's never been here before. He's never had such low poll numbers, but he's been quite near them, and those moments were basically September 2001, just before the terrorist attacks, and January 2003, just before the Iraq War. So on both occasions, just as he came down here, his prospects were sort of transformed by terrible national security crises. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, that might happen again, but assuming it doesn't, it'll be the first time that he's in a position of sort of negotiating with the Senate, with the House, and presenting a national agenda to the country from a position of this sort of weakness. And he's always been able to get his policies through the Congress, essentially by ramming it through the House, where they have a pretty solid majority, and then using his popularity to sort of intimidate people in the Senate. Well, he doesn't have that popularity anymore, so we just don't know how he's going to be able to manage Capitol Hill.
A couple of issues I want to raise with you quickly. Another Democratic presidential debate this week. A difference seems to be opening between them on international trade.
Yeah, this is an old Democratic fault line, of course, and we're seeing it reopen. There's Kerry, Clark and Lieberman in the sort of Clinton position of being in favor of free trade and also in favor of keeping some of the tax cuts. And then Dean and Gephardt in favor of managed trade and also in favor of getting rid of all the tax cuts. So trade's opening up as being a very divisive point for the Democrats, just at the time when the economy in general is proving a real weakness for the administration.
Lord Hutton's inquiry came to an end. A report will be issued in December. This has shown a harsh light on the Blair government and, for that matter, the BBC. What have people seen?
During the Hutton inquiry, the BBC and the government were sort of compared, and people in Britain generally found the government to be the less reputable, the less trusted. But as the inquiry ends, people are just looking at the BBC itself, and they're beginning to see that the kind of old-fashioned sort of global viewpoint, the sort of restraint and Olympian quality, which I think we see here in the BBC World Service, just doesn't exist anymore, or not to such great extent in Britain, because the BBC is competing in a much fiercer marketplace and is beginning to take on a lot of the sort of more aggressive qualities of commercial rivals in order to survive. And this isn't going down very well because it's a public service network. And
I'm afraid I've got to cut you off on this public service network. John Parker of The Economist.